You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today, we're lucky to have with us Elizabeth Elo, author of North of Boston. I have to say, to genreize it, a mystery thriller which combines elements of... Well, it combines a lot of elements. The protagonist, Pierrot Kasparov, is a sarcastic, feisty, determined protagonist who, in a very humane search for the killer of her best friend's almost ex-husband, Pierrot is more multifaceted than a diamond. She's the daughter of Russian immigrants, an expert in perfume and the chemistry of fragrances. She also happens to be impervious to hypothermia. She could almost be cast in X-Men. Anyway, it's a gripping story with as many twists and turns as a Dashiell Hammett novel. So welcome, Elizabeth, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
So, like, the bad news is I have laryngitis. The good news is it'll be the first time that I let the author talk more than I do.
So I hope that's good news.
I hope so, too. So, you know, people have compared this, you know, in many ways. Do you consider it a mystery thriller? Is that the way you look at your book, or do you not care not to label it at all?
I would prefer not to label it at all, but if it has to have a label, I would say it's suspense.
Well, when you talk about... Am I pronouncing Pierrot right? Is that how it should be pronounced?
Yes, you are.
So when you thought of Kasparov as her last name, was it because of the chess player Kasparov, or is there some actual family connection?
No, that was the first name that popped into my head, and I have a superstition about names in fiction, and I like to go with the first thing that pops into my head. I think if you think about it too much, that you're maybe it's a little too forced, and that name popped into my head. The name Pierrot popped into my head, and that became her name.
I think it's nice when authors do that because it's like Ayn Rand and Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. She came up with such interesting names that you remember them all your life. And you could easily do it here, too. I mean, I can remember Ellsworth Toohey and Howard Rourke and Hank Reardon, all the characters, Peter Fallon. And I think people will do that with yours because they're such interesting, different names. Like even Thomasina.
Mm-hmm. That name popped into my head as well, but you know what I like about it is I want the names to feel like they belong to real people, and a lot of times people have names that aren't melodious, and they don't seem to make sense together. You know, not all of us have names that sound like theater people or celebrities, so I like that sense that it's kind of raw.
And also, I think it kind of encapsulates a character and helps you to, I guess, contextualize him. Like Melosa, Pierrot's father, Melosa Kasparov is a great name, and kind of gives you an idea of what he's going to be like. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the story first, so it's not just me meandering on.
It's a story about a woman, about 30 years old. She's helping out on her friend's lobster boat near the Gulf of Maine, northeast of Boston. It's very foggy, and out of the fog comes a huge freighter, smashes into the boat. She jumps overboard, but the captain of the ship, his name is Ned, he goes down with the boat and perishes. She, for some reason, is able to stay alive in the Atlantic Ocean by clinging to some wreckage and is saved by the Coast Guard. When she comes back, she doesn't realize that people are thinking that she's amazing. She doesn't know why. And then it turns out that she just did something really unusual, and that is she survived in this very cold water for longer than anybody thought a person could survive in it. So that brings up really two plots that are going on, or three plots that come off from that. And one is, what is this special ability that she has? You know, the Navy gets into the act and wants to start testing her because they do research in, you know, human survival in extreme conditions. And then the next part of the plot is that Ned left behind his 10-year-old son, Noah, whose mother is struggling with alcoholism. So Pierrot was drawn into that family to try and, you know, stabilize it or make sure that Noah's taken care of. And then the third plot is what happened out there. Was it an accident?
Yeah, she really has a lot on her hands, doesn't she?
She does, yeah. I could even add another one, too, which is she also has a family, a father and a mother, a stepmother, and their business. So, you know, when I wrote the book, I knew that I was biting off a lot, and that a lot of times books don't have as many facets to them, I guess. But I really wanted to portray somebody in the totality of their lives. And so you do, in all of our lives, we have jobs, families, friendships. In her case, she has this crime thrown in. But if you go through an average person's life and look at what they really do, we're all operating in a lot of different areas at once in any one given day.
That's true. Well, you know, but what about the idea of, it looks to me like you must have done enormous research into this, or else you had some, connection to these things. So, for example, with regard to the hypothermia, or with her knowledge of perfume, are those things that you researched? Are they actual things that belong to your life?
Well, a little bit of both. I love to read nonfiction, and I had been reading about the sense of smell and perfume and things, and that just came into the book very naturally. And in terms of hypothermia, I did a lot of research on that. I didn't know anything about it when I started. But there are other aspects of the book that come from my life. I grew up as the youngest of four, and my three older siblings were fanatic sailors. And, you know, for example, I have a brother who sailed to Tahiti and back. I have a sister who's right now planning to sail around the world.
Wow.
And another brother who's a ship's captain, a commercial ship's captain. So this whole idea of the water and boats and the ocean really is part of who I am from way back. And, you know, as an adult, I've lived in Newburyport, Mass., which is a little seaport town about 35 miles north of Boston. And there's a little fishing industry there, and I lived near the water there, too. So, the ocean is just part of who I am, and that part is easy to me.
You know, it's interesting, and you may already know this, but Robert Frost, the poet, has a collection of poems called North of Boston.
Yes, I knew that. In fact, that's why I rejected this title for the longest time. I thought that I couldn't use it, and I felt that it was a little cheeky of me to start, you know, stealing Robert Frost's title, but... when we got to the point of selecting the title, that was the only one that kept coming up over and over again. So
it wasn't your choice, but it was part of the publisher's, and as well as the cover, too, which is a great cover.
Yeah, it's a terrific cover.
Well, it's interesting because, I always ask whether the author gets a chance to vet the covers. Did you go through a lot of them and then, you know...
No, this is the first one they sent, and they sent it, and I looked at it, and I said, that's terrific, that's it. Look no more, we found it.
Cool.
Hallelujah.
Well, it's funny because some of the reviews make it seem like some aspects of the book, which I won't get into, are far-fetched and couldn't happen, why this, why that. And, you know, I thought about it for a while, and the only reason they're doing that, in my mind, is because Pirio is a woman. There are tons of novels in which men are able to accomplish some of the things she does, even though they may seem like, oh, wait a minute, how did that happen? But no one ever gives it a second thought. But because she's a woman and a strong woman, she's able to accomplish the same things, much like in a Dashiell Hammett novel, like The Maltese Falcon, which is actually referenced in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Funny you should say that, because I've actually received a number of emails from people who have said they only say that because... she's a woman, just exactly what you said. Luckily for me, the vast majority of the reviews have been very positive.
And, oh, yeah.
But, you know, there are a couple of cranks out there, and that's what they object to. You know, she's not, this could never happen. And, you know, as I said, I wrote the plot. It went along in its logical progression, and one thing led to another. And I tried to stay true to her character and to what, you know, logically would happen in the certain situations that she found herself in. And, of course, as in any interesting book, you know, it gets pretty dicey at times. And I think that's the exciting part of it, that's the adventure, that's the thrill of it, that didn't happen, it would be kind of boring.
Yeah, but it's like, it's what's so nice about her, not nice, but interesting, is she's sarcastic, she's cynical. Even in a crisis situation, she takes time to have a sense of humor. It's no different than Humphrey Bogart or Bruce Willis in movies where they do exactly the same thing. Don't you agree?
Uh-huh. Yes. I'm glad you feel that way about it. That's definitely true. I mean, that you can't just jump out of character. I mean, you know, any of us, when we're in character, I mean, we are who we are, and we respond consistently.
Yeah.
So she's not going to suddenly become, you know, a shrinking Violet because things get a little rough. If anything, she's going to be more in your face, you know.
Yeah, and it is funny, and it's a serious book, but it really makes reading it fun because you actually know as a reader about halfway through, you know, she's going to come back with a good one-liner. And so it kind of, you know, you always know there's going to be something around the corner where she's going to act like that, like in the chapel scene. And that's been mentioned in the reviews, too. But it's not like she is taking time out of her quest. She's just interacting with people as she moves forward. Just so happens she happens to be funny.
Right. And I think that she also sees what's irrational or absurd in people's behavior. And when you have a character who's very clear-eyed that way, she can't turn, as I said before, she can't turn it off. And she sees things that are incongruous or hypocritical, and she immediately says that.
Yeah, it's like, and look, she's got, you know, Thomasina's a complete mess, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she has to deal with Thomasina, and then, you know, Thomasina's son is this, like, incredibly erudite, intelligent, humorous guy with a very dry sense of humor. And, you know, it's a wonderful relationship. What would the book be like if you didn't create relationships like that?
Exactly. And I think one of the things that happens with crime novels is that you see the protagonist in always searching for the criminal. So they're always in that hard-boiled facet of their lives, you know. And what the reason that I wanted to include Curio's family and her friendships was because nobody's like that all the time. So she has these other facets of her life which show her being loyal to her friend, being softer and tender, you know, with this child who needs her, trying to be better with her father and her stepmother and having the challenges that we all face in that, trying to renegotiate our relationships with our parents when we get older. You know, that's all part of who she is. So she's not always just a, you know, a wise guy running after, you know, criminals.
No, and, you know, she tries real hard with her father, with Melosa, and she reaches a kind of resolution, as she does with her stepmother. But at the end, because of what he says to her, in a way, it almost, you know, I thought the book was going to be tied up and the reader would be done and wouldn't think about the future of the characters. But because of their last conversations, it almost sounds like there could be a sequel. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that's kind of cool for the reader because it gives them something to think about.
Right. Well, I've always felt that way about endings. An ending is an ending to this book.
An
ending to this event or this adventure in her life, but things don't stop. And threads from this continue into the future. So, and her father, Melosa, points that out to her at the end of the book. Says, you think you're over.
I know. And that kind of caught me by surprise, but then I realized, you know, the kind of person he was. Why don't you tell the listeners what kind of person her father was and what he'd been through?
Well, he grew up in Russia in some little village, which he never wants to talk about. And as a young man, he went to Moscow as, you know, capitalism was starting in its kind of unruly phase. And he met Perio's mother, who he started... she was a very beautiful young girl, and between the two of them, she became a fashion model, and they moved to this country. And this was in the days, I don't know if you remember that, but when I was growing up, there was this Russian fashion model, this was a long time ago, and her name was Verushka.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, and she had this incredible appeal. I remember staring at her photographs for long because she was so strong. But so beautiful, but in a very imposing, gorgeous kind of way. And I guess she must have made an impression on me because later on I started writing about this Russian fashion model who was Pirro's mother.
It's funny because I kind of almost thought of her because in your first scene where you set her up, the way you describe her eyes and the way they're ringed with the black makeup, I had that same feeling about what she must look like.
Isn't that interesting? You know, I wonder if somehow we're not all connected in this, in our culture, of all these little things that become meaningful, that you would have that connection. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I know, but the problem is now we're all caught up with the Kardashians or something, or Miley Cyrus's tongue.
It's a little scary to think about where that would lead in the future in terms of literary expressions and things.
Well, that's another thing in your book is, you know, what kind of book published today is going to reference Yevgeny Yevtushenko, you know, one of my favorite poets, and then Mozart's Piano Concerto number 21, which is also one of my favorites. You just shove so much stuff in here. And, you know, then there's a subplot about Pirro's mom and what she did in the summer and a whole new set of characters.
Right. Well, you know, that's what makes writing interesting to me. I think I'm the kind of reader, I'm very easily bored when I read fiction, and I almost prefer to read nonfiction because I'm always learning something. So with writing fiction, I have to keep it interesting for myself. So I put in what I think is part of the story. And I'll just come back to the same idea that I had before. It's like, if, you know, we're all listening to music, so why not include the music? You know, all of these details. You know, some people, for example, like myself, remember Yevtushenko as a great poet. And if I'm thinking of him and making that association, why not put it in the book?
Yeah. Well, but you also add really interesting touches, like when she comes up and listens to Melissa listening to it. First of all, her favorite part is not his, but then he actually rewinds it and starts at the beginning, which I thought was really interesting. You know, it's something you just thought of, but then it resonates kind of. You know, why wouldn't he? I do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Like with the Kinks, you really got me. I always rewind it to the first chord. And, you know, it's just something people do. And but you don't often see it so that you recognize it as such.
Well, you know, first of all, I love the Kinks too, so I'm glad that you mentioned that. But the fun of doing that as a novelist is taking those moments and then bringing character into it. So, for example, when they're burying the hamster, you know, she starts thinking of poems that she can recite, and you know, it turns into a moment between her and Noah that you really wouldn't have expected from, you know, just her making that quotation. But that's what I like to do, is have those moments show the characters.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't know she remembered that poem. I don't know, I remember certain passages, but if the appropriate time came up, it could just bubble up like that.
Right. And fiction is a great place for things to bubble up and for associations to be made. I know when I was writing it, I realized, actually, after I had finished writing it, that there was a part of my life that came into the book that I didn't even remember until after I had written the book, and that was the fact that in high school, I had a job at an aquarium in which we had dolphin shows, and two of the dolphins had been together in captivity for a long time, about 10 years, and they were Salty and Spray. We used to swim with them after hours, which also sort of comes into the book. But one of them died, Salty died, of a skin infection. And Spray, who went to the bottom of the tank and hardly ever came up again and refused to do any shows. And about 6 months later, she had died as well. And I remember thinking, you know, these animals have very intense bonds and they have a social life. We don't understand it, but they're not just fish swimming around. They're not people either. But, you know, they have very meaningful social bonds.
I was just in Cancun like 2 days ago, came back with an 80-degree temperature differential. It was weird. But right outside our room was this dolphin pool, gigantic, as big as a football field. And at night while you were trying to sleep, you'd hear the dolphins. My daughter said it's like they're at recess because they weren't working. And you could hear the dolphins like breaching the water and going up and slamming down. And for a while, I had no idea what it was. And then I realized, and it was like so beautiful, you know, the darkness. And then you go out and on the balcony and you see these shapes and just rising up and then going back down. And you know they're at play. It was I don't know why I'm doing that, but it was kind of a wonderful moment.
Yeah, it is. And they do play. And
I think they're smarter than we are. I think they're smarter because they can't manipulate the environment like us. They don't have arms and legs. They don't have opposable thumbs. So all they can do is think. Mm-hmm. I think they just think the cosmos. I think mm-hmm. they're way smart.
Mm-hmm.
The other guy is Russell Parnell. And the other thing you do with him is you don't have to do anything with his appendages, yet you do. And I'm wondering, okay, what? You're sitting there writing and you go, oh, I think I'll make him have, you know, if you want to talk about it.
Oh, yeah, you can talk about it, yeah.
Yeah, one of his arms is, it's like a Bob Dole kind of thing, I think, but one of his arms doesn't function properly, and I'm wondering, why does she create a character like that? And then I realized, because there's people like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that a lot of times, things like that, and I know writers have done this for ages and ages, where there's something physical about the character that makes them have a slightly different life experience than the rest of us. And he wants very much to be on the edge of this search for the criminals. But for very literal reasons, he can't do things. Like, he can't crew on a boat, and he can't swim as well as some other people. And, you know, it affects who he is and his fear level, even though he tries to hide it. And, you know, it just, yeah, so that's kind of why it's there. Although I didn't intend for it to be there, it's just when he showed up, that's what he looked like.
That's so amazing that you do that. Well, you know, as I was thinking of that, too, I was thinking, because I can envision the scenes almost as if I'm looking at a storyboard. And that's why I was wondering whether you think maybe, I mean, this would be a great, I think it would be a great movie. Don't you?
Uh-huh. Sure, I'll go with that. Actually, I got some in conversation with a couple of people saying, well, who would play Perio? Because she's like, you'd need a special kind of actress to play her.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be the girl next door. But that would be fun. But when I write, I see the scenes in front of my head and in front of my eyes. And I have a very visual thing in mind when I'm writing. I literally see the people. I see what's on the desk. I see what their expressions are. It's like almost like a movie happening before my eyes.
You know, if you cast her as like one of the Saturday Night Live people, like Kristen Wiig or Tina Fey, if they look the right way, because they have that sardonic twist, but I think they could also play it straight as well.
Yeah, that would be great.
And Melosa, I wonder who would be Melosa.
Oh, yeah, that would be, I'm thinking Donald Sutherland would do a great job.
Yeah, he would, or William Hurt, not William Hurt, what's the other guy's name? The guy who was in the new version of Lolita, Jeremy Irons.
Okay. Yeah, and then you need the really kind of unstable ex-boyfriend, you know, somebody like...
Ooh, he was a mess.
Yeah.
He was mean. I didn't think he was as mean as he was going to be, and neither did she.
Uh-huh, right.
She didn't think he was capable of what he did.
Yeah, but one of the things that I wanted to get at in this is the fact that nobody really started out being evil. They, you know, the fishing industry contracted, and people had to, you know... There were quotas put on how much groundwater or how much groundfish you could bring in. So a lot of these fishing companies were really under a lot of pressure, and a lot of them just sold their fleet and went out of business. Local fishermen went out of business. And, you know, so companies had to kind of respond to that. So, you know, the bad stuff in this book begins with people just trying to adapt and react to, you know, a situation. Unfortunately, they do it in the wrong way.
Yeah, and that was an argument that was put forth by one of your antagonists, and you think about it, and you think, okay, let's take Syria, for example, and what's happening there, and the horrible situation, and then you compare it to what's happening in your book, and maybe you do go, well, what is more important, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
So his argument wasn't totally specious, but it did give rise to me thinking about that. I mean, mm-hmm. aren't human beings... You know, in little kids' lives, more important than a quest for something else.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You threw it out there, right?
Uh huh. Right. Right. And the whole idea that, you know, we're meant to survive. I mean, humans have an instinct to survive, and they're going to do it whatever way they can. You know, and in some ways, we don't have a choice. I mean, we're gonna try and perpetuate the species, and and we have that in us.
Yeah, it's like so. the prime directive.
Right.
Well, I know you got another interview right after this, and I could go on with lots of questions. But I really, really loved your book. I have an independent bookstore, which is a sponsor for the show. It's called Wellington Square Bookshop here in Westchester. And your book is right out front, and it's doing very well. And it's really the kind of thing that keeps us going, because it's really hard to be an independent bookstore.
Oh, I know. And it's great that you're doing it, and it's great that you've got my book and other books out there, because, you know, you guys are the ones that make it work for people like me, because Barnes & Noble won't do it. It's you smaller independent booksellers that, you know, hand sell the books. And so a book like mine can come to public attention.
The other good thing about it is, at Barnes & Noble, you're not going to meet someone who's going to say, "Hey, get this book. I read it. This is what it's about. It's great." Whereas everyone in our bookstore does know that, and it makes it a lot easier for the reader. And we know our audience. We know what they like. So yeah, I'm really pleased doing this. It's a labor of love, but I love doing it.
Great. Well, thank you for supporting my book, and I hope you sell a lot of copies.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, yeah, thanks again.
All righty. It's great to talk to you.
Likewise. So, anyway, that was North of Boston's book, just published this year by Elizabeth Elo. Great book, great thriller, great mystery with a lot of comic elements in it. excuse me. So, anyway, I would strongly suggest that you come by Wellington Square Bookshop and pick up a copy of it. And then next week, I think I'm going to rebroadcast Rachel Kushner's book, Flamethrowers, because she recently appeared at the library and talked about it and signed copies. Maybe you were there. And I'm going to see if I can get her to come in and maybe give me 5 minutes more about, you know, the book's been on the bestseller list since we interviewed her, and that's when it came out. So it's been there for like 2 years. Excuse me again. And it's been there as long as Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn, who we also interviewed. So I figured as long as it's out there and people love reading it, they probably love hearing it about again. So I'll see if I can get her to give us a new intro. And I think that's what it'll be. I don't like to rebroadcast them too much. If I find somebody else that's, you know, more au courant, books just came out, maybe I'll do that. But I liked Rachel so much, and I love the book, Flamethrowers. So hopefully that's what we'll be doing next week. In any event, thanks as always. I apologize for my voice today. Apparently, though, unfortunately for you, it didn't stop me from talking. So I enjoy being here. I enjoy having all of you come by and listen to it. And remember, go to iTunes in a couple of days or a week or so, and you'll be able to listen to it again, which would be torture, but you could. Okay, talk to you soon.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.